Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Asperger's syndrome, often described as high-functioning autism, has been listed separately in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders since 1994. But under proposed changes to the new edition of the Psychiatry Encyclopedia, Asperger's would be folded into the broader category of autism spectrum disorder. Joining me here in the studio to talk about this and to give us the latest on autism, Gardner Harris. He's science reporter for the New York Times. Joining us from Yale University, Dr. Fred Volkmar. He's director of Yale University's Child Studies Center. And Dr. Edwin Cook speaks to us from his office at the University of Chicago Medical Center. Of course, you are always an important part of the program, so I hope you'll join us with your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Gardner Harris.
Good morning, Diane.
And Dr. Volkmar, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Diane.
Dr. Cook, thanks for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning.
Dr. Cook, could you describe for us what is Asperger's syndrome?
That's an excellent question. I might best talk about it in the context of the previous criteria of the DSM-4 that you mentioned were established in 1994. But I'm going to keep my comments brief because Dr. Volkmar has written much more extensively on the answer to that question.
All right. And when you talk about the DSM-4, you mean the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. So go right ahead.
Well, in the previous form or the current form of DSM-4, Dr. Volkmar and his colleagues have a situation in which if you meet criteria for autism, which we could go into detail with, but it might take the full call, then you don't diagnose Asperger disorder. However, if you fail to meet criteria for autism, then one can consider diagnosing Asperger disorder. The distinction, once you get past that, in other words, it's in a sense left over if autism wasn't diagnosed. The distinction then is that, and there are some other details to the criteria, but one of the important parts of the criteria is there's no language delay and there's no general cognitive challenge. So, for example, that IQ would be over at least over 70 in a lot. People would expect it to be over 80. A key thing to remember is that you mentioned high-functioning autism and Asperger as if they would be the same thing, but today, if someone had intact language after an initial delay, they would not be able to have Asperger. They would have to have high-functioning autism.
All right. I'm going to turn now to Dr. Volkmar. Give us an example of a typical child you've seen with Asperger's.
Oh, let's see. A typical child would be, let's say, a boy of about 10 who's always been gifted verbally, who's very verbally precocious, often The parents will tell you he talked before he walked. They'll say things like, words were his lifeline. He talks all the time. However, he has horrible social difficulties and major problems in communication. This would be a boy who typically had some unusual interest, which he would also tend to want to talk your head off about. And that would be kind of a prototypical, classical example of what Asperger was talking about as he first described this back in 1944.
All right. Now, if you would, Dr. Volkmar, describe to us a child with autism.
Well, that, of course, is the interesting debate. Is there a distinction to be drawn? And I think that the distinctions have to do both with research and clinical implications. And one of the complexities, and as Dr. Cook pointed out, we could spend a whole hour talking about just the complexities in a wonderful academic sort of way, but the complexities in terms of same or different are these. I think the children with Asperger, to my mind, have verbal strengths, whereas children, even higher functioning children with autism, often the verbal is not necessarily the leading edge of their strength. They may be better at some nonverbal activities, and the verbal may be in the normal range, but it's not quite in the gifted range that it often is in Asperger's.
And what about physical differences, Dr. Volkmar?
Well, I think the differences are really in terms of the history and the clinical presentation, to the extent that there are differences. And there's clearly a lot of similarity in terms of the social difficulty. I think one thing that the DSM-IV got right about the Asperger's business, and there were some things that they didn't get quite right. But I think the one thing that was right was that the social difficulties are defined the same way as they are for autism. These are very severe and persistent social problems, but somewhat paradoxically, they exist in the face of relatively good language skills.
Hmm. Dr. Fred Volkmar, he joined us from Yale University. Also on the line is Dr. Edwin Cook. He's an autism researcher at the University of Illinois, Chicago, a member of the American Psychiatric Association's work group proposing the changes to their diagnostic manual. So now I want to turn to you, Gardner Harris, because you've heard, you've seen, you've read about this change that the American Psychiatric Association is proposing. What's your view? What is your interpretation? And why are parents so upset?
Well, the parents are upset because, of course, there's much more stigma attached to being diagnosed autistic than being diagnosed with Asperger's.
Why?
Your listeners would know. I think there is this sense that Asperger's can be, you know, someone with Asperger's can be quirky but brilliant, is the sort of sense of the attachment to that. Whereas someone with autism is someone with a severe illness. And, you know, you begin to think of the sorts of things that our mutual friends, the Busbys, with their kids, that they might have to be institutionalized, that you sort of go through the much more serious sets of problems. And, of course, in Fragile X syndrome, which is a common cause of autism as well as mental retardation, you have the retardation that's associated with it. Asperger's, of course, is usually very pretty high IQs, as Dr. Cook talked
about.
And high functioning. And so, you know, but I think what both of these psychiatrists are talking about is that it's difficult to make these fine distinctions between what is a high-functioning autistic child and what is a child with Asperger's. Obviously, they go toward, you know, the language deficits. Are there deficits, or is that a strength of them? But when you get into a clinical setting, these doctors obviously know this stuff much better than 99% of the psychiatrists out there. When you get into a clinical setting, these sort of fine distinctions often get lost.
Dr. Cook, can you explain to us why there is this move to group the two disorders together as opposed to maintaining their distinguishing set of characteristics?
Well, I think that this has been alluded to in the previous comments, that one may describe what one thinks of in perhaps a stereotypic term of someone with autism or someone with Asperger. And it's easy to make a description of people that you would think would come from two different disorders. But in practice, there's several problems that as if you want to make discrete categories, there are too many children and adults that don't, quote-unquote, read the manual to fit neatly within one category or the other.
But what about the implications? What about medications? What about insurance? What about all those down-to-earth practical things that could result if the two are combined, Dr. Cook?
Well, that's a great question because, as a matter of fact, I've had situations where providing the code for Asperger has led to a child who would now fit within autism spectrum disorder to not be eligible for payment for service or for various kinds of very appropriate educational intervention.
What about the reverse?
I'm actually not sure so much about the reverse, other than the discussion that I understand that if someone has the misconception of what autism means, that in a sense stigmatizes someone, I think we have to address that with education, that people understand, first of all, I don't think we want to label or stigmatize anyone, but secondly, that we recognize that our criteria do include, importantly, to recognize the level of functioning so that we would not be saying there would be a way to distinguish that someone would qualify for services appropriate to their language level and their cognitive level.
Dr. Edwin Cook, he's an autism researcher at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Short break, and when we come back, I see we have many callers. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can. We're talking in this hour about autism and Asperger's syndrome, two diagnoses that may be combined in an upcoming revised edition of Psychiatry's Diagnostic Manual. With us here in the studio is Gardner Harris. He's science reporter for the New York Times. On the line, Dr. Edwin Cook. He is a member of the American Psychiatric Association's work group proposing the changes to their diagnostic manual. On the line with us also, Dr. Fred Volkmar. He's professor of child psychiatry, director of the Yale University Child Study Center at Yale, and he is also the author with Lisa Wiesner of A Practical Guide to Autism, What Every Parent, Family Member, and Teacher Needs to Know. Here in the studio is Gardner Harris. He's science reporter for the New York Times. Here's a tweet, and we just got this a minute ago. How have the changing DSM definitions of autism and Asperger's change the incidence and prevalence of these disorders in the U.S. Dr. Volkmar, can you comment?
It's a very good question. Before 1980, autism was not actually recognized as a diagnosis. And in the first two editions of DSM, if you had autism, you would have been said to have childhood schizophrenia, which was a perfectly nonsensical state of affairs, but that's the way it was. In 1980, autism was included for the first time as part of what was then called DSM-3, or the third edition of the DSM. And that actually really remarkably stimulated research and as well as clinical interest in autism. There were a number of variations of the DSM. DSM-4, which was published in 1994, was the last one. In both DSM-4 and what's called the ICD, or International Classification of Diseases, 10th edition, the definitions of autism essentially are the same, and it was done to be sure that they were the same. And one of the things that we identified as a problem in doing both DSM and ICD at that point in time was a tendency of the previous versions of DSM to underdiagnose autism, and of course we also included Asperger's, but in more able individuals. So as a result, I do think that as a result of the newer criteria, we picked up more children and adolescents and adults that in the past would have been missed because their conditions wouldn't have sort of gone into the previous model of autism being a disorder that was largely or totally confined to people with intellectual disability or mental retardation.
All right. So Dr. Volkmar, what do you see, if you do, what do you see as a clear benefit of folding Asperger's into the autism spectrum disorder?
I think the trouble is there's always a tension back and forth basically between lumping and splitting. Everything all happy together or everything split apart in some more rational way. And that's an understandable tension. It goes back and forth. I think from my point of view, from the research and the clinical point of view, it's worth having some potential subgroups. And I think you can make a case in terms of the research findings that there are some potentially very interesting things about Asperger's that might be worth very specific research.
Studying separately.
Exactly so. And clinically, I think the fact that the children have sometimes very good language gives you a way in of intervention so that we can actually use language, words, we can be very explicit, we can use special routines. There are different strategies that basically would arise that wouldn't necessarily so easily apply to the more classically autistic child.
Here's an email from Annie who says, I'm one of nine children. My youngest sister has a son diagnosed with Asperger's. Another sister has a son diagnosed with autism NOS. I don't know what that means. Do you know what it means?
Well, your doctors on the line will be able to talk about it much more than I. These are the folks that I call when I do my stories.
NOS, Dr. Volkmar?
Not otherwise specified.
Okay. Then she goes on to say, I am the mother of two daughters. I'm concerned my daughters may be at greater risk of having children with autism or Asperger's. Please comment. Now, number one is autism or Asperger's more commonly found in boys, Gardner.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, the question that is on everyone's mind here, Diane, is, of course, is autism increasing in frequency or are we just seeing it more? Is there really something going on? And there are obviously parents groups who are deeply concerned about this, that there is something going on in the modern world that is sickening our children. Is it plastics? Is it vaccines? Is it something else? There's a new study about maternal age, which obviously more and more women are having children at a later age. As the doctors, Dr. Volkmar and Dr. Cook have talked about, I mean, we really only started looking for autistic children in the 1980s. So obviously there has been a huge increase in the diagnosis of these children. Is there something really going on there? Are we just seeing it more? Most people, I think, say that there's something going on.
You wrote a story just recently about the question of vaccines. Tell us what you found.
Well, we've written a ton of stories about vaccines and autism, and none of them make any difference, of course, because there is a huge number of parents out there who fervently believe that vaccines led their children to become autistic. All the studies have gone in the other direction. We just recently, of course, wrote about a fellow named Andrew Wakefield, who was a British researcher who postulated that the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, somehow led to some sort of chronic measles infection in children that then damaged their brains and led them into having both sort of chronic gastrointestinal problems as well as autism. His research has basically fallen apart in retrospect, and through a series of investigations, both by British journalists and by British officials, it's been discovered that he did a variety of unethical practices in his research and also had a bunch of financial conflicts that may have led him to cast doubt on the safety of the MMR vaccine. The result of his scare in 1998 was that vaccination rates in the UK fell precipitously. There were outbreaks of measles throughout the United Kingdom, and children died. In this country, there is still a very fervent anti-vaccines movement, and they've latched on a variety of theories. Dr. Wakefield's theory about the MMR, another theory about thimerosal, which is a vaccine preservative that contains mercury that has since been eliminated from nearly all vaccines. And then a sort of a more recent theory about mitochondrial disorder. The end result of all of these is that they keep coming up with ideas to sort of justify this notion that vaccines somehow play a role. And study after study has shown that this is not the case, but it just doesn't matter. The real question here, Diane, is there something in our environment that is doing this? Is it simply increasing maternal age? And is there really something going on? Are we seeing these children because we're looking, or are they really more of these children around?
Dr. Volkmar, how would you answer that question?
Well, it's interesting, and I suspect that Dr. Cook and I would be in general agreement on this. It's clear that there's very strong genetic aspects to autism and related conditions, including Asperger's. And in fact, as I think someone alluded to earlier, it's not uncommon to hear of families where you see children with both kinds of problems, or in the extended family. And in fact, there may be some very strong genetic connections between the two of them. The strongest scientific evidence by far that we have has to do with genetic factors in autism. And Dr. Cook is a real expert on that. He and I have collaborated in a number of different genetic studies. It's a really very interesting time in autism research because we're close to being able to look at very particular genes in autism.
So currently, as I understand it, 9 out of every 1,000 8-year-olds were diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder as of 2006. But isn't it true, Gardner Harris, that you've got real variables around the country?
Sure. I mean, there was a recent study that came out about hotspots in California, for instance, of autism. And, you know, these hotspot stories are always very dangerous for us as journalists because there can be very simple explanations for a hotspot. You know, in California, the hotspots could result because some certain places have simply better services for autistic children. So there is, it pushes parents to sort of suggest the diagnosis. Hmm. There can be, if you have a handful of practitioners, clinicians in an area who are much more aggressive about diagnosing it, you're going to have more children diagnosed. So in this study never really acknowledged those sort of factors, which is why we didn't put the study in the New York Times. I think that the real question, this is definitely a genetic disease. You and I have a friend who their children have Fragile X, which is the most common reason for that we've identified for autism. It is a single genetic defect, what's a Mendelian genetic defect. There's Rett syndrome, which is also another clearly identified gene that's associated with autism. And there is an extraordinary level of research going on right now looking at some of these single gene defects and how they might lead to autism. You know, in the 90% of kids, there isn't an obvious single gene that causes this. But I think a lot of researchers are thinking that if you can look at Fragile X, if you can look at Rett's, and if you can somehow find the pathway in those children that leads to autism, it could have effects for 100% of the kids out there. And if you can come up with some treatments, and there are some clinical trials going on right now in those children, maybe those treatments could have effects in all of these autistic children.
Gardner Harris, he's science reporter for the New York Times. On the line, Dr. Frederick Volkmar, he's at Yale University School of Medicine, and Dr. Edwin Cook at the University of Chicago. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Dr. Volkmar, I want to ask you about something that was in this morning's Washington Post, a new study suggesting a nasal spray containing the hormone oxytocin that could help those with autism. Or perhaps it's Dr. Cook who can tell us about that.
Oh, I'd be glad to speak about that.
Good.
It's a very exciting study following on some previous work by Dr. Eric Hollander's group showing some positive benefits from a nasal spray containing the hormone oxytocin, which we all have in our bodies, but there's been some earlier evidence and more evidence in this study that it may be lower in those with autism. Oxytocin is a very powerful hormone that not only relates to delivery at childbirth and lactation, but also is involved in the social brain. Our group has some evidence, along with others, that the oxytocin receptor gene may be implicated in autism.
And what happens when the oxytocin nasal spray is used?
Well, in this study, there were two interesting findings. One was to see better social function in a very sophisticated way that one would need to read the journal. And another very interesting thing that's relevant to Dr. Volkmar being on the phone is they saw an improvement. Again, this is short-term. This is not a treatment. It's just a short-term, one-day administration. People shouldn't be rushing out to get this from other countries. But even to show in the short term that and it's interesting, they either had high-functioning autism or Asperger's disorder. It didn't make a difference in terms of response. The oxytocin improved the amount of time spent looking at the eyes and the face, not only the face but the eyes, which Dr. Volkmar and his colleagues have done some very important studies showing that people with autism or Asperger do not look enough at the eye region of the face and pick up cues.
Didn't the study also involve throwing or catching a ball?
Yes, that was the social game that they saw improved function with.
My concern about talking about this is that it involved only 13 adults.
Oh, there's no question this is a very preliminary study. They did have some of their findings replicated in another smaller group, but there's no question that it's important that you emphasize that whatever we see needs to be replicated in independent laboratories as well as groups of subjects and larger groups. But most importantly, this was not a study showing that oxytocin works as a clinical treatment. It's simply more of a laboratory study moving us perhaps further in that direction. But
Dr. Volkmar, do you want to comment?
I would really just agree with what Dr. Cook has said. I would urge people not to necessarily run out and try to get it on the street. But it's an interesting study, and I think one of the things we really need are more and different kinds of studies looking at some of the core deficits, including social deficits.
Diane, what this really gets to is that there is this enormous hunger out there for treatments.
For something.
Like, there is this sense, I think, for a long time from parents that the medical world has sort of abandoned their children, and which is what this has led, I think, parents down some very dangerous pathways. It's very common for parents to chelate their children, which is, you know, to use these very powerful drugs to sort of somehow leach out the heavy metals from their bodies because of this sort of wacky theory that this might have been caused because of some sort of heavy metal poisoning. There's a lot of these kids being forced into hyperbaric oxygen chambers because of some, again, wacky theories that somehow the oxygen is going to improve their children. So there is an enormous hunger out there. And, you know, even with these small studies, for instance, again, going back to Fragile X and Rett syndrome, I mean, these syndromes are devastating, and they are absolutely clear in their pathology. And if you can get some sort of treatment that has an effect, even in 20 kids, drug companies will be all over that because it will rapidly go to market.
Gardner Harris, he's science reporter for the New York Times. Short break, and when we come back, we'll get to your calls, your email, and your tweets.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. And by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org. This is NPR.
The impeachment of President Clinton revealed political fault lines that still divide our country. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ken Gormley, who's written a new book about Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr's investigation into Clinton. It contains some surprising revelations about how an investigation into a land deal became an investigation about sex. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We're back, and it's time to go to the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Alex. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I'm autistic, actually. I was diagnosed when I was 9 with Asperger's syndrome. I'm 23 now. And I was actually wondering why the news isn't including autistic people's opinion about this as much as, you know, professionals and parents. An example, you know, is this panel, which doesn't include any autistic people. I actually run a website for autistic people called WrongPlanet.net, and we have more than 33,000 members, and we see this shift as a good thing. In fact, it's great because autism is actually how we refer to ourselves. I refer to myself as autistic.
Interesting. Dr. Cook, were there no autistic individuals on this panel?
No one who self-defines as having autism is on the panel. We have sought, before the draft criteria, input from several groups. I'm happy to say there are so many groups of people self-advocating that we couldn't check in with every one. And we look forward to having input in the in this public discussion, particularly to hear from those with autism spectrum disorder who may speak for themselves. It's a wonderful change that we now can have this communication and dialogue, and one that I hope will continue moving forward.
Dr. Cook, I wonder if there's a website that you have to whom people who are diagnosed with autism can turn.
For information or about the new criteria?
Both.
Well, I would actually recommend Dr. Volkmar's website for information, but before I hand it back to him, the place to comment and to read the rationale about the changes is found in www.dsm5.org, and one can then look at all of the DSM-5 proposed criteria, but specifically about Asperger's disorder.
Now, is there any way to comment on?
Yes, there is. People simply have to get a username and password, and there's an opportunity to comment. And
excellent. Dr. Volkmar, do you want to give me a website?
Sure, absolutely. Then let me make a comment, too, if I might.
Surely.
The website is www.autism.fm, like the radio, and that's a shorthand way of getting to the Yale website.
Okay.
www.autism.fm. Let me just make one comment, which is, you know, the Asperger's autism business is one part of what I think is a broader sort of interesting set of issues. And as Dr. Cook knows, and I admire him and his work and my colleagues on the DSM-5 task force very much, I actually resigned from the DSM-5 work group because I felt the process this time was unfortunately not at the same level as the process last time.
How so?
Well, I think it's an interesting, and the question of having the input brings this up. It's wonderful to have input. Now, that being said, if we were doing a diagnostic set of guidelines, let's say for kidney cancer, would we necessarily want to expect having a lot of input from patients with kidney cancer in terms of the diagnostic guidelines? And the answer is probably no. And I realize it's not quite so simple as that, but yet that raises an issue, which is the science. And I think one of the things that I've found this time, that there's a lot of attention to thinking about how will this, as it were, fly with the lay public, and I'm not necessarily opposed to that. It's worth having the input. On the other hand, I think last time there was much more attention to having, and this is not just for the Asperger's, it's for the whole business, having a real process of doing peer-reviewed studies, studies that went through the peer review process where there's published data to say this is the alternative, these are the changes we've looked at, this is what makes sense to us. And I have found that sadly somewhat lacking this time around, unfortunately.
Interesting. All right. Let's now go to Melissa in Jones, Oklahoma. Good morning to you.
Good morning. I would like to ask doctors for any input on treatment. My 10-year-old grandson has been diagnosed with autism, and they're having trouble controlling the emotional issues, the outbursts, the suicide threats that he makes when he gets so frustrated.
Gardner,
very good question.
Sure. Go ahead, Dr. Volkmar.
I was just going to say, it brings up a very interesting issue, and I think one that we haven't really talked so much about. We've talked about medicines, but I think it's important to realize two things. One is that the real standbys for treatment these days are educational and behavioral interventions. They have made a profound difference for the better in many people, children with autism, Asperger's, doing much better over the long haul. If you look at the outcome studies, there seems over time to be a major shift in terms of improved outcome, and that's a testament to the better programs behavioral programs, special educational programs, other kinds of interventions. And there are more and more of these that are really well evaluated scientifically. There's a number of excellent books and resources. You mentioned the book that my wife and I did, but there's a wonderful book from the National Research Council called Educating Children with Autism that came out in 2001 that talks about this. Dr. Cook, go ahead.
What about medications, Gardner?
Well, obviously, these two guys are the doctors, but as you know, Diane, out in the field out there, there's a lot of these kids who do get on medications. They get on antipsychotic drugs, which are very powerful medicines with serious side effects, metabolic side effects. They get fat. And this brings up the larger issue, I think, in the DSM of these other diagnostic codes. For instance, one of the huge controversies at this DSM is about pediatric bipolar illness. It was an illness that, or a category that exploded in popularity to deal with children with explosive tempers. And they sort of borrowed this bipolar label from the adults and then sort of brought it down into kids, even though there was sort of very little evidence that these two were related. So this new DSM basically suggests getting rid of the pediatric bipolar label, and the result may be that far fewer children will have these very powerful medicines, antipsychotics. But the classic, in answer to this grandmother's worry, there are no cures out there, obviously. They're all about symptom relief treatment. And, these kids have serious OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder problems associated with them. They're often treated with antidepressants. With the explosive anger, they are often treated with antipsychotics, which really, were once called major tranquilizers because they sort of down-regulate essentially all behaviors.
Here's an email from Janelle, who says, I have a nephew who's 3 years old, who's been diagnosed with autism. His mother has heard that gluten may have something to do with autism, has put the whole family on a gluten-free diet. I'm studying to become a dietitian. She's asked me for information. I've tried to look into it, have not found any good, solid information. Dr. Volkmar.
Well, she's unfortunately discovered one of the problems, which is with the alternative and complementary treatments, alternative meaning in place of, but complementary meaning in addition to, there, by definition, there's not going to be much in the way of solid scientific evidence. The dietary treatments have been pursued for years. There's a tiny amount of research, but not nearly as much as there should be. They really can't be seen as established. I tell parents if they're doing that as the only thing, it's the mistake. Many parents will do it in addition to treatments like special education and behavioral treatments that have been shown to work. It is hard to get information. We actually had a chapter in our book on alternative treatments just for that reason, but it's hard for people to get good information.
But the question becomes, does a gluten-free diet help?
Well, the reason why a lot of this dietary stuff has come up is that parents' groups, anyway, have found, and it's backed up in some of the clinical work, that a lot of these children have gastrointestinal problems. Nobody's quite sure why, what's going on. There might be some. There are hormonal receptors in the GI as well as in the brain. So there might be something going on with that. Nobody really knows. So it's led to this sort of plethora of dietary treatments that are often talked about as cures, supplements, all this sort of it can get very serious, and entire families can change their diet. Whether it works or not, nobody knows.
Gardner Harris, he's science reporter for the New York Times. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go back to the phones to Peoria, Arizona. Good morning, Michelle. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have an 8-year-old son who I think kind of typifies some of the problems under the present model of strict definitions. What we find here in Arizona is that your child can be classified as, PDD, NOS, or all these other things in the spectrum. But if you don't have that autism diagnosis, I think it's 2.99, you are ineligible for state services. It's harder to get services in the school. Insurance can give you a hard time. And my son started out at 2.5 at risk of PDD, which is pervasive developmental disorder. Then at 4, he was PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental order not otherwise specified. And it wasn't until he was 5 that he got the full autism diagnosis. And I kind of figured out around 4 is that's what we needed to have. He's very high functioning. And if you don't have that autism diagnosis, you can't get all the early intervention that you need, which is really critical with these kids, no matter where they are on the spectrum. And it breaks my heart. I have seen so many kids that were denied intervention because they weren't quite on the, you know, they didn't quite have that 2.99 diagnosis. And I'm hoping with the change in the model, if we just call it all autism spectrum disorder, that people can get the early intervention they need. My son, fortunately, we actually had the financial resources to do a lot of early intervention and to actually, quite honestly, to be able to go to a psychologist who could do a really in-depth evaluation of him and to get us that 2.99 diagnosis. Because quite honestly, he's kind of on the line with Asperger's.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Diane, this is why the numbers on incidents are complete bunk often, because you have these sort of issues going on in communities, which is you have a parent saying, look, doc, if I don't get the 2.99, I am not going to get the services I need. So, of course, it leads doctors to often sort of upregulate the diagnosis on the child because everybody wants those services. But I'll tell you, none of this is going to change with this change in diagnosis.
Nothing.
No, I don't think so, because insurance companies, look, you know, we could talk till we're blue in the face about healthcare reform. Insurance companies are going to find a way to separate out the most severe from the less severe, and they're going to find a way to deny services to those they don't think are more severe, whether it's sort of within these diagnostic codes or not. And so all of this stuff is why the sort of the numbers, just counting diagnoses, gets very fraught, because you don't know whether it's because of insurance reasons or real diagnostic reasons that they're getting it.
All right. Let's hear another view from Corey in Oviedo, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I would like to, I do have some relevant thoughts on this matter. What I would like to say is I am an 18-year-old with Asperger's syndrome, and I am a little bit put off by the NPs who put together the DSM-5. And I would like to leave you with this thought, Diane. I have Asperger's, and I also have brown hair. Let us say that I take a strand of my brown hair and another strand of blonde hair from a boy with autism. My strand of brown hair represents Asperger's syndrome, and the other boy's strand of blonde hair represents autism. Now, these are two different strands of hair from two different scalps under which are two different brains wired in two completely different ways. So let me just say that if the NTs who put together the DSM-5 really understood the mysteries of Asperger's syndrome and autism, they would have categorized them differently.
Dr. Cook.
I'm aware of that. That gets back to what Dr. Volkmar was talking about lumping and splitting. And the problem is that one of the phrases that's been going around is that we, in seeking to deal with diagnoses, want to find where nature has natural splits, and this is being suggested by blonde and brown hair. But the reality is most of nature is on more of a continuum than this or that, and I understand that there are some people that see these things as completely distinct, but as we look at the literature, and as alluded to earlier, there'll be someone in a family with autism and someone with Asperger's, and particularly the distinction of high-functioning autism and Asperger's really doesn't matter how you got there at 18. If you're very verbal and you're very bright, does it really matter if your language was delayed when you were 4 years old?
Probably. And that's the great challenge of psychiatry, Diane. I mean, there's no blood test that's going to tell you, you know, which little category that you're going to fit in. And it often depends upon the clinician that you're going to see, the kind of questions they ask. I mean, these sort of fine distinctions, once they get out in the community, are very difficult to make.
So does all of this come down to how much money we put toward research into autism, Dr. Volkmar?
Well, it raises a very interesting set of issues, and it's hard to know where to start. I think, just to follow up on Dr. Cook's point, that One of the interesting tensions, back to the lumping and splitting business, is does it make sense either in terms of clinical work? I mean, to my mind, it does make some sense to have some distinctions. Or research, and I think actually you could make some case for the research implications as well. But ultimately, what we need to remind ourselves is we need to do right by people, children, adolescents, and adults with real problems. And so the question there is, what's the best way to do that? I think one of the broader problems with what's been proposed is, if you look, we're not just losing Asperger's, we're losing the whole ball of wax. It's all becoming autism spectrum, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but that means we lose autism. Now, does that mean that as we talk about this very broad view of autism, that everybody should be entitled to the same amount of services? Because sadly, and consistent with the observation about the insurance companies, and it's also true about schools, and there's tremendous variability from one part of the country to the other, sometimes having the autism label gives you more service. Well, one of the dilemmas now is we're going to take that same pool of service and divide it among a much larger number of children. And so, it's a problem.
The whole issue is a huge problem. I want to thank you all so much. We've got to clearly find a way to talk about this more, to hear what kinds of possible solutions are out there. And why, Gardner, as you said, is happening so frequently. Gardner Harris, The New York Times, Dr. Fred Volkmar at Yale, his book, A Practical Guide to Autism, and Dr. Edwin Cook, autism researcher at the University of Illinois. Thank you all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.